America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. We're at a point where so much has changed in government policy and practice in response to 9/11 that we can no longer see those changes. They just seem so accepted. Some measures are very apparent. We have a Homeland Security Department with a lot of responsibility. We never had one before. We prosecuted two wars and finally extricated ourselves from the last of them in Afghanistan. But we have technology all over the world now to detect over-the-horizon threats. And yet there are many other subtle and less obvious ways that 9/11 has affected how our government operates. Some may seem more pernicious than others. All seemingly make it harder for you and for me to figure out what the federal government is doing at home and abroad. Let's discuss something you may never hear anywhere else, but you will today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Karen Greenberg. She's the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law, an international studies fellow at New America, and a permanent member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And she's written a wonderful book, one that's a little tough because it reminds us of some things that have trailed us since 9/11. The book is called Subtle Tools, The Dismantling of American Democracy, from the War on Terror to Donald Trump. And I've got to tell you, Karen, I don't think it has really come to mind for most Americans that this legacy of 9/11 and all the actions that we took subsequent to it, and you give us some of the more dramatic ones like the Patriot Act and, of course, the ability to use military force, which has been in force for over 20 years and has been used somewhat indiscriminately. I mean, some of these things we know, but there are many things that you tell us are still going on in the name of fighting terrorism or for our security that we have no idea about.
The point of my book is sort of to say that the policies are one thing, and so many of the policies, as you said, the Patriot Act, the authorization for use of military force, are still intact. For the most part, the Patriot Act's been replaced by the Freedom Act, and the authorization for use of military force is in discussion for being replaced with something else. But the fact is, we still live policy-wise in the shadow of 9/11, including with the Department of Homeland Security, which was created to address terrorism specifically. But my further point is that it's not just the institutions and the policies we need to address, which we do need to address, but the underlying way in which those policies, laws, institutions were created. And that those, what I call subtle tools, were very impactful, very dangerous, it turns out, and still are on the table to be used again should someone come along and want to use them for expansive presidential powers and basically a lack of accountability at all levels for any deviation from laws and norms.
And you attribute a lot of this to imprecision in terms of language, a lot of fuzzy, squishy language that has been employed in some of the authorizations and the statutes subsequent to 9/11, which really do give broad interpretive powers to those who are in power at any time.
That's exactly right. The use of vague language, it's not new to know that if you use vague language in the law, you can extend the law to whatever you'd like. So, for example, the authorization for the use of military force abroad did not name an enemy, did not name a geographical location, did not name a temporal point at which hostilities would end. This is in contradistinction to our prior authorizations for force and our declarations of war. And it was done knowingly and intentionally. And now we have the use of force wherever the president would like to use it, whenever he'd like. And imprecision in language haunted the war on terror in so many different ways. We created Guantanamo Bay. They couldn't be called prisoners because that would invoke the laws of prisoners of war pertaining to prisoners of war under the Geneva Conventions. So we called them detainees until we came up with a better term, which was unlawful enemy combatants. So in other words, we're creating with terms that didn't have any legal resonance, didn't have any precedent, and so we just made up new words. And so this just gives you an example. This went on in many, many different sectors. And the imprecision that I'm talking about, which starts with language and continues through not just the Bush presidency, but Obama finds some recourse to imprecise language as well. But it was also in the imprecision of what on earth the Department of Homeland Security's mission was. You know, and I think that's a problem of governance that is profound, which is that when you take so many different agencies from Health and Human Services and Agriculture and Justice and Defense and more, and FEMA, for example, and you put them all together, what's the agenda? What's the mission? What's the chain of command? How does that work? And so it was fuzzy from the beginning. It remained confused and imprecise, and it became, as we saw under Trump, an agency that could pivot to whatever the president wanted it to be, whether it was for the southern border or for the Black Lives Matter protest in Portland and elsewhere. And so it was actually created where this kind of cloudiness, fuzziness, confusion, imprecision turned out to be a very powerful tool for the executive and the president.
You say that over the course of the next two decades, subsequent to 9/11/2001, a vastly different America has taken root. Now, I know the America that I'm living in today, and you're living in it with me, is not what I want it to be. How much of that, some of the polarization, the imperial presidency, the threats to our democracy, I mean, how much can you put that at the doorstep of what happened after 9/11?
You know, it's a really good question, and I know there are those who say, look, we've been living with these divides, but just ignoring them or pushing them aside forever. And I think that's also a valid argument, but there's no question in my mind that 9/11 gave a huge leap forward to, for example, policies of discrimination. So first, it was rampant Islamophobia in a number of policies, both in terms of law enforcement, in terms of intelligence collection, authorities, and more. And that kind of, you know, racial, ethnic othering and suspicion bred an open door to the allowance of other kinds of racial acting out and, you know, discrimination. And I just don't think that you can separate this, that the age of being allowed to hate the other was opened up widely by the war on terror and its deployment of Islamophobia, its support of Islamophobia. So that would be one thing. I think that our standing in the world, this is not a hard one to argue, our standing in the world has been vastly altered by the war on terror, not just by our deployment of forces in so many different places, but also, and our use of military action, but also by Guantanamo and by the use of torture. What does it mean for the world that the United States, which stood at the helm in creating human rights governance policy and policies, abandoned that role? It's a profound thing, and it resonates at home as well as abroad. So those are just two things, you know, come off the top of my mind that I can think of that were transformative because of 9/11. In terms of the political divides, I think that has to do with the fact that I would word it differently, and I would say that the empowerment of political wrongdoing by lying, by doing things in secrecy and more was definitely given a jump forward by 9/11. I argue that one of the subtle tools that many would say was not so subtle, but in its very definition is subtle, was the use of secrecy as a weapon, starting with Bush, and the amount of things that were kept secret that the rest of the world knew about. They knew that their family members were being tortured. They knew that their family members were being dragged away to Guantanamo and other places. And all of these things were authorized in secret, and it took years in some cases to figure out where, how, and what the White House authorizations or legal authorizations from the Department of Justice has been. And there's still some things in terms of surveillance policy, in terms of torture that was practiced that we don't know. And then, you know, you jump ahead to President Trump, who took secrecy to entirely new levels by deciding that the best way for secrecy was not to create the documents. So, forbidding notes to be taken at certain important meetings, not keeping statistics on immigrants who are separated at the border, you know, the family separations at the border, so that reuniting them, knowing that it happened and reuniting families are both sort of, you know, especially hard things to accomplish, that notion of secrecy as just don't create the record, don't let White House officials testify if they're subpoenaed. This kind of thing got way out of hand, but it started in a big way after 9/11.
Let me ask you this. What does it say about America and the American experiment? This was a horrific event, obviously, 9/11. However, we have had one of the most protected homelands, if you will, in the history of civilization because of the Atlantic and Pacific. I know the British got in and burned down the White House and such in 1812. But when you look at us compared to those countries that have contiguous neighbors who are their enemies and how many times they've been invaded over and over and over, the reaction to 9/11, as horrific as it was, what does it say about the American character that we then went really over the top? Two wars, again, one was very questionable, one that, of course, we just got out of 20 years later with no good effect. When you look at it all, was it an overreaction? And what does it say about the American character?
There's a number of things. I think that has to be answered in several ways. One is the trauma and the shock of being attacked, giving, you know, hundreds of years of just thinking, as you said, that we were inviolable from the north, south, east, and west. It wasn't just our oceans. It was also who our borders connected with, right? Just not being fearful of that in a way that turned out to be, you know, a wrong assumption. You know, so the reaction was amazingly aggressive and showed that trauma. I think the real question is, why was there no reset? Why was there no, let's even take it out 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. Why was there no point after institutionalizing these new laws, these new policies, these attempts at new norms? Why was there no point at which Congress could say, we need to think about this. We know who we are. This is not who we are. We do actually believe in the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Eighth Amendment, to name some that had been grossly violated by policies implemented after 9/11. We need to rethink. We need to reset. And I think one of the big lessons of the way the United States reacted is it would be great if there could be built into some kind of, you know, procedural regulation that any acts that are transformative in whatever way or in the name of war, whatever it is, have to be rethought and reconsidered after a certain point. Because it's hard to expect a nation not to react strongly, but it's inexcusable not to have a moment of reflection, to never say, wait a minute, let's just take a time out. And unless that's required, it's probably not going to happen. So anyway, one lesson.
Well, let me ask you, Phil Mudd was an interviewee of mine, and he was very involved in counterterrorism. You see him on CNN all the time when there's any terrorist activity, and very interesting guy. And when I interviewed him, he said, we've learned a lesson. America will never do some of this again. America will never do the torture. America's learned from this. And, you know, again, he was not, you know, covering up for the agency that he was once involved with at the CIA, the counterterrorism group. He said, we overreached and we've learned our lesson. Have we?
I know Phil well. I haven't talked to him in a while, but yeah, I think he speaks for a lot of people But that, and he, I think what he means is the people who went through this and who saw how quickly things were changed and how little input there could be for those who might have disagreed, you know, that we were going down this path from the highest level. That, yes, that the pushback would be very strong these days, much stronger than it was after 9/11. But that neglects future people who are not yet part of the agency or the federal or the FBI. And that, I would say, overly optimistic about what can happen if these precedents and these tools that I'm talking about are left on the table for others to use.
You say that American faith in government was shaken by surveillance and investigations of American citizens. And we've had so many investigations, so much back and forth, particularly under Donald Trump, accusing various parts of the deep state of various things. So therefore, he was able to take advantage of the fact that after 9/11, there was this emphasis on making certain it never happened again, and we'll collect the data we need to on you and such, therefore creating this distrust in the deep state, yet allowing him then to abrogate rights along the way as he saw fit whenever he just used the deep state as the cover.
You know, it's funny. I don't really use the deep state as a kind of, it's not really something that I write about, but I take your point, which is, you know, how much of this is just, you know, casting blame one way or the other. I think we all bear a responsibility for what goes wrong and what went wrong. I think part of using the term deep state gets at this issue of thinking that so much is secret, right? And therefore, those who are in the know of what's secret, you know, it sort of leads to kind of conspiracy theories on the outside. And that's one of the reasons I think transparency is such an important value and such an important principle. You know, Obama came into office and he was very adamant about establishing transparency. You know, I think on his second day in office, he issued a presidential memoranda to that effect, recognizing the damage that secrecy had done in terms of trust in the government, as well as other things. And he wasn't really able to reset it. And we still live in this kind of shadow of the power of the president and the executive to claim secrecy, often in the name of national security, for a variety of things that the American government should know about. And so I think that, you know, moving into a more transparent relationship between the citizenry and the government is actually very important and something that's very hard to do in the wake of 9/11, in the sense that there are threats that are talked about all the time, and in the fact that the trauma of 9/11 in some ways, and for a lot of reasons, hasn't dissipated as much as you might have expected after 20 years.
When you look at the various impacts of all of this, you do talk, of course, about the Department of Homeland Security, and you also talk about the Department of Justice. And again, that's been a very controversial department, but that they've been complicit in this. And you say even before Donald Trump and William Barr.
Oh, absolutely. The book I wrote prior to this was called Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. And it really talked about how the capitulation of the Department of Justice in its many forms was part of what damaged the American governance and American political character so impactfully. So the Department of Justice in the Bush days was responsible for, under John Ashcroft and then under Alberto Gonzalez, was responsible for writing the memos which authorized torture, writing the memos which said that international law, the Geneva Conventions, did not apply to those who we had in our custody, who we detained. And it cleared the way for surveillance powers that were broader, that you have referred to, that were broader than anything one might have imagined would be lawful, and for curtailing many constitutional rights. So I think that the, you know, to talk about the Department of Justice's role in setting the war on terror on its in the wrong direction is instrumental. And Trump recognized the importance of using the Department of Justice. and with Sessions, but more importantly with Attorney General William Barr, used it sort of as his clearinghouse and his cudgel to be able to interfere with processes, to be able to decide what agenda prosecutors should have in mind, who they should be looking into, often with political purposes. We saw that when it came to the protests. And we saw that when it came to the Department of Justice's heavy hand in immigration policy and immigration proceedings. And so it's interesting that Attorney General Merrick Garland, among one of the things he's done in this time in office, has to issue a directive talking about the need to have in place firm independence of the Department of Justice from the White House, and setting out a set of criteria about when communications should take place, under what conditions, and how to reinforce this independence. So, you know, this is recognized that the capitulation of the Department of Justice and the erasure of the barrier between that and the DOJ and the White House needed to be addressed.
Karen Greenberg is our guest. The book is called Subtle Tools, The Dismantling of American Democracy from the War on Terror to Donald Trump. Let me say this. You say that the first subtle tool, and we talked about it, is the degradation of language. It's a starting point for political dishonesty. Then you go into a few other subtle tools that I'd love for you to give us some illustrations. The next was bureaucratic porousness. What does that mean?
I know. That was a term we kind of like, should we use this? It actually means imprecision among and between and within the institutions of government. So, for example, what I was just referring to, the porousness between the White House and the Department of Justice, and the porousness between the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security is the largest law enforcement agency in the country. I think that would surprise many to know that. They might think of that in terms of the Department of Justice. Mm-hmm. But in fact, there is a lot of that goes on between these two departments. It's not, it needs to be further clarified. It was not clarified when DHS was set up. It still remains to be clarified. As I said, Merrick Garland has tried to clarify and to overcome that porousness between the White House and the Department of Justice. And it went further than that. It also went to within the Department of Homeland Security itself. Who was responsible for what? That remained confusing between the confusion between agencies, which was set out from the start as something that was going to happen. We saw this particularly with Hurricane Katrina. What happened in the response to Hurricane Katrina? The Coast Guard, did it have the lead in responding? They weren't sure. Did FEMA have the lead in responding? And there were miscommunications and misunderstandings, and the result was people died. And so, you know, they knew early on that there were problems with command structure, that there were problems with mixed authorities, but that still remains within the Department of Homeland Security and needs to be fixed. And let me tell you, one of the reasons it doesn't get fixed is not just that they don't see it. It doesn't get fixed because it's nice to have that kind of fuzziness, that kind of blurriness, the kind of, well, maybe we could, for example, you know, the DHS agents were able to deputize others who didn't have training, who didn't have, you know, necessary credentials to be border agents. All right. That's probably something that when you're thinking about clarity of mission and clarity of departmental integrity, which is the opposite of bureaucratic porousness. You wouldn't be able to do. And so just to give an example, is it just got out of hand in many places? And I focus on the Department of Homeland Security.
Well, it's a good thing to focus on. I mean, when I was reading your book, I was reminded how off-putting the whole notion of the Department of Homeland Security was at that time. And you get into it in the book, this Teutonic World War II sensibility about the term homeland. And you would wonder why at this point, let's say, when Joe Biden is saying, all right, I want to get out of some of this 9/11 mentality. He recently announced this other relationship with Australia and the UK to focus on China. And I think by getting out of Afghanistan, he was trying to say, we've got to close this chapter. We've got new issues that we've got to deal with. But why somebody wouldn't say, Now, let's break down this department. We had FEMA outside of the department beforehand. We had an office of Homeland Security of some sort within the White House. But why not break it back down to its component parts?
You know, that's a really good question, and it comes up a lot with people I talk to. There are a number of people who say, yes, we need to break it apart. At this point in time, I just think it would be maybe more of a mess and more of a hassle than it's worth, and it might amplify the problems that I think of imprecision, of lack of clarity of mission, strategy, etc. I'm not one of those who thinks taking it apart is the best idea. It is possible they could take certain things out of it and either move them back into their original agencies or, like FEMA, make them freestanding. But at this point, I don't think it's worth it. I think the better idea is to clarify what it's actually about and make it very clear that it can't just take on a new agenda. For example, it was created as a counterterrorism institution, created new immigration departments for border and internal immigration matters. And, you know, just to say, if it's not just counterterrorism, let's define what it is. It can't just be a free-for-all for that which threatens the homeland. And so, I just can't envision how it would be taken apart.
Well, where is the Department of Homeland Security? I know they're dealing with border issues that are pretty dramatic right now. I hear Secretary Mayorkas talking about this. He seems like a nice guy. He seems like he's somewhat in control of the facts. But, you know, there are situations that are a little bit out of control. And I'm really wondering, like, what role do they play when domestic terrorism today is more on our minds than some of the foreign terrorism?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And so let's go back to the creation of Homeland Security and just remember that it was created as a counterterrorism measure. We're going to take these agencies, we're going to put them together, and we're going to fight terrorism in a way we didn't. And because we didn't, we ended up with 9/11. That was the premise. That was the idea. They didn't put the FBI inside Homeland Security. FBI is the lead counterterrorism agency for the homeland, right? Mm-hmm. Was at the time. What is? So that was already an interesting sign. Now, when you look at domestic terrorism, the lead agency on domestic terrorism for investigation and, you know, leading to prosecution is once again the FBI, right? And mm-hmm. So there may be ways in which DHS will be brought into the conversation. It's an interagency conversation, you know, with a variety of agencies. I still think it's the FBI that will take the lead on that. And to your point about Mayorkas, he inherited such a mess when you think about it, right? And they're trying their best. And you can feel that they're trying their best. They go out, they try one thing and there's pushback. They try something else. I mean, I do think they're trying very hard to fix this both incrementally and in the aggregate.
You then talk about subtle tool number three, secrecy and withholding of facts. Now, there are many who might be listening to this saying, hasn't government always done that? And aren't various things shrouded in mystery forever? And we wait 40, 50 years for some opening up of the public records. What are you saying about the nature of secrecy and withholding of facts within, say, the federal government as a result of 9/11?
Some things have to be classified. Some things have to be kept secret. But everything, right? I mean, you get the feeling that if they could just put the word national security on it, you saw this in cases that went through federal courts. You saw this in foreign policy. You saw this in congressional discussions. So much was off limit and couldn't be known. There has to be some cabining of what is national security and isn't. So I'll give you an example. Now we know that national security it is really about many more things than terrorism. It's about climate change and the effects of climate change. It's about pandemic and the effects of pandemic. Don't you think the American public needs to know some of these things? How much of it is going to be kept secret? And more importantly, not just in terms of threats, but in terms of the response. The responses the United States took to 9/11 have damaged us in the world in a variety of ways, in terms of potential partnerships, in terms of trust, in terms of even creating other terrorists. How much had the American public and members of Congress known about certain things, that measures that were taken in their name? How much of that might not have happened? And so, of course, there has to be some kind of secrecy, but they're all, this really gets to a very, to another point. Secrecy ties to this direct, which is that what secrecy is about when it gets expanded in the way it was expanded after 9/11 is the lack of accountability. The fact that no one in the top levels of government or who was responsible for the torture, creating the torture policy and implementing the torture policy has been held accountable, even by a narrative that the American public can see that actually names who, how it happened, who did it, and what was wrong with it. The fact that we don't have that is not okay. And so, you know, you want to know what country you belong to. And just so you know, there are things, let's say, in the torture report that Dianne Feinstein's Senate Select Committee on Intelligence did, 6,000-page report, we've only seen 500 pages, right? So what have we not seen? And what is it that other people to whom this was done and to whom they've talked, what is it that the rest of the world knows that we don't know? It's not okay.
Now, the fourth subtle tool. And this one really, when you think about it in aggregate, it makes you wonder, really, is this government functioning on our behalf anymore? The abandonment of legal and procedural norms for lawmaking, oversight, judicial review, and transparency. I mean, it doesn't get any more difficult to imagine in a democratic republic that all those things have really gone by the boards as part of this.
That's right. In a way, the fourth tool is done with the others in tandem. Like, it can't be done without them, but the ultimate result is this willful abandonment of laws and norms. The amount of laws that were sidestepped about privacy, one's right to one's own information, one's not to be right not to be surveilled without a warrant, except in certain circumstances, but instead just in a blanket way. The ban against indefinite detention in the way it was conceived after the war on terror started. This willful abandonment of norms that were considered basic to, you know, life in America has been very dangerous and a very bad pattern to set. And you've seen it get out of hand, you know, on a number of occasions. And you know, you talked about the disruption of judicial processes. The what we see now going on with the Supreme Court, with its intervention or its almost interventions or its partial interventions at early stages of cases that have to do with abortion, that have to do with voting rights, is something that had been there before 9/11, but that took on a lot of extra momentum in the years after 9/11. And it's all part of this larger story of, you know, disruption of laws and norms. And in that particular, in this particular way, it was the Trump administration that really gave a huge boost to the idea that laws and norms could be pushed aside at the will of the president.
How much do you think the American public in its gut, because we don't study this stuff very much, we move on, and I don't think many people even could recite to you any provision in the Patriot Act anymore. But, I mean, how much do you think the American public understands about how much we have changed?
That's a really good question. I worry that the American public has got complacent about the fact that Congress isn't really attuned to doing oversight, except for in, you know, highly politicized issues like, you know, we've seen of late. I think that there's so much going on that the idea of looking at the mechanisms of government is not something that the American public would really want to get exercised about. But I do think the American public can be schooled and would appreciate not wanting to be in a persistent state of warfare, and not wanting to have a Congress and courts that defer to the executive in a way in which the checks and balances in which the country was founded, you know, have been compromised so severely. And I think, you know, you learn this in elementary school, I think, about, right, the three branches of government. And the fact that the president has become this powerful, the fact that people aren't held accountable, officials aren't held accountable, I actually think that the American public will care about that. The American public's held accountable. They're held accountable all the time for what they do. Why not our officials? So I think I think there are points at which it can matter and points at which it might not matter, and they may be different for different people. But I do think that presented in the right way, Americans would care about it. I think Americans would just like to not be the pawns in this disinformation campaign. I think the idea of being able to trust government and of government doing things, whether it's in more transparent measures, whether it's more outreach to explaining what's going on in various departments, whether it's more just plain approachability. I think the idea of rebuilding trust in government is very important and something Americans would appreciate.
Well, I hope more Americans will read your book, and I hope you get on other platforms. I'm glad you're on mine. I really am. But this message, really, because I think you've unpacked some things that I don't think a lot of people are thinking about, and yet they are so pervasive in our society, our culture, our politics today, that we now take some of these subtle tools for granted, and they've been absorbed into the body politic, unfortunately. Well, listen, I want to thank you, Karen Greenberg. The book is called Subtle Tools: The Dismantling of American Democracy, from the War on Terror to Donald Trump, and I'll say, and beyond. Thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a wonderful conversation.